Chapter 28. They crossed the Magaliesberg and turned west along the mountain range. Then, 2 months after they had left the Limpopo River, they reached the Boer settlement at Louis-Trichardt. Sean left Mbijeni to outspan the wagons on the open square in front of the church, and he went to search for a doctor. There was only one in the district. Sean found him in his surgery above the general dealer's store and took him to the wagons. Sean carried his bag for him, and the doctor, a grey beard and unused to such hardships, trotted to keep up with Sean. He was panting and pouring sweat by the time they arrived. Sean waited outside while the doctor completed his examination, and when he finally made his descent from the wagon, Sean fell on him impatiently. "What do you think, man?"
"I think, Menhir, that you should give hourly thanks to your Maker."
The doctor shook his head in amazement.
"It seems hardly possible that your wife could have survived both the fever and the loss of the child."
"She is safe, then? There's no chance of a relapse?" Sean asked.
"She is safe now, but she is a very sick woman. It may take a year before her body is fully mended. There's no medicine I can give you. She must be kept quiet, feed her well, and wait for time to cure her."
The doctor hesitated.
"There is another damage."
He tapped his forehead with his forefinger.
"Grief is a terrible destroyer. She will need love and gentleness. And after another 6 months, she will need a baby to fill the emptiness left by the one she lost. Give her those three things, Menhir. But most of all, give her love."
The doctor hauled his watch from his waistcoat and looked at it.
"Time. There's so little time. I must go. There are others who need me."
He held out his hand to Sean. "Go with God, Menhir." Sean shook his hand.
"How much do I owe you?"
The doctor smiled. He had a brown face, and his eyes were pale blue. When he smiled, he looked like a boy.
"I make no charge for words. I wish I could have done more."
He hurried away across the square, and when he walked, you could see that his smile lied. He was an old man.
"Mbijeni," said Sean, "get a big tusk out of the wagon and take it to the doctor's room above the store."
Katrina and Sean went to the morning service in church next day. Katrina could not stand through the hymns. She sat quietly in her pew, watching the altar, her lips forming the words of the hymn and her eyes full of her sorrow. They stayed on for 3 more days in Louis-Trichardt, and they were made welcome. Men came to drink coffee with them and see the ivory, and the women brought them eggs and fresh vegetables. But Sean was anxious to move south. So on the third day they started the last stage of their trek. Katrina regained her strength rapidly now. She took over the management of Dirk from the servants, to their ill-concealed disappointment, and soon she left her litter and rode on the box seat of the lead wagon again. Her body filled out, and there was colour showing once more through the yellow skin of her cheeks. Despite the improvement to her body, the depression of her mind still persisted, and there was nothing that Sean could do to lift it. A month before the Christmas of 1895, Sean's wagon train climbed the low range of hills above the city and looked down into Pretoria. The jacaranda trees that filled every garden were in bloom, masses of purple, and the busy streets spoke well of the prosperity of the Transvaal Republic. Sean outspanned on the outskirts of the city, simply pulling the wagons off the road and camping beside it. And once the camp was established and Sean had made certain that Katrina no longer needed his help, he put on his one good suit and called for his horse. His suit had been cut to the fashion of 4 years previously,
and had been made to encompass the belly he had acquired on the Witwatersrand. Now it hung loosely down his body, but bunched tightly around his thickened arms. His face was burnt black by the sun, and his beard bushed down onto his chest and concealed the fact that the stiff collar of his shirt could no longer close around his neck. His boots were scuffed almost through the uppers. There was not a suspicion of polish on them, and they had completely lost their shape. Sweat had soaked through his hat around the level of the band and left dark, greasy marks. The brim drooped down over his eyes, so he had to wear it pushed onto the back of his head. There was, therefore, some excuse for the curious glances that followed him that afternoon as he rode down Church Street with a great, muscular, savage trotting at his one stirrup and an overgrown brindle hound at the other. They pushed their way between the wagons that cluttered the wide street. They passed the Rathsaal of the Republican Parliament, past the houses standing back from the road in their spacious purple and green gardens, and came at last to the business area of the city that crowded round the railway station. Sean and Duff had bought their supplies at a certain general dealer's stores, and now Sean went back to it. It was hardly changed. The signboard in front had faded a little, but still declared that I. Goldberg, importer and exporter, dealer in mining, machinery, merchant and wholesaler, was prepared to consider the purchase of gold, precious stones, hides and skins, ivory and other natural produce. Sean swung down from the saddle and tossed his reins to Embigeni. "Unsaddle, Embigeni. This may take time." Sean stepped up onto the sidewalk, lifted his hat to two passing ladies, and went through into the building where Mr. Goldberg conducted his diverse activities. One of the assistants hurried to meet him, but Sean shook his head, and the man went back behind the counter. He had seen Mr. Goldberg with two customers at the far end of the store. He was content to wait. He browsed around among the loaded shelves of merchandise, feeling the quality of a shirt, sniffing at a box of cigars, examining an axe, lifting a rifle down off the rack and sighting at a spot on the wall, until Mr. Goldberg bowed his customers through the door and turned to Sean. Mr. Goldberg was short and fat. His hair was cropped short, and his neck bulged over the top of his collar. He looked at Sean, and his eyes were expressionless while he rifled through the index cards of his memory for the name. Then he beamed like a brilliant burst of sunlight. "Mr. Courtney, isn't it?" Sean grinned. "That's right. How are you, Izzy?" They shook hands. "How's business?" Mr. Goldberg's face fell. "Terrible, terrible, Mr. Courtney. I'm a worried man." "You look well enough on it." Sean prodded his stomach. "You've put on weight. You can joke, Mr. Courtney, but I'm telling you it's terrible. Taxes and worry, taxes and worry." Mr. Goldberg sighed. "And now there's talk of war." "What's this?" Sean frowned. "War, Mr. Courtney, war between Britain and the Republic." Sean's frown dissolved, and he laughed. "Nonsense, man. Not even Kruger could be such a bloody fool. Give me a cup of coffee and a cigar. We'll go through to your office and talk business." Mr. Goldberg's face went blank, and his eyelids drooped almost sleepily. "Business, Mr. Courtney? That's right, Izzy. This time I'm selling and you're buying." "What are you selling, Mr. Courtney?"
"Ivory."
"Ivory?" 12 wagon loads of it." Mr. Goldberg sighed sadly. "Ivory's no good now. The bottom's fallen out of it. You can hardly give it away." It was very well done. If Sean had not been told the ruling prices 2 days before, he might have been convinced. "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that," he said. "If you're not interested, I'll see if I can find someone else." "Come along to my office anyway," said Mr. Goldberg. "We can talk about it. Talk costs nothing." 2 days later, they were still talking about it.
Sean had fetched his wagons and had offloaded the ivory in the backyard of the store. Mr. Goldberg had personally weighed each tusk and written the weights down on a sheet of paper. He and Sean had added the columns of figures and agreed on the total. Now they were in the last stages of agreeing the price.
"Come on, Izzy, we've wasted 2 days already. That's a fair price, and you know it. Let's get it over with,"
Sean growled.
"I'll lose money on this," protested Mr. Goldberg. "I've got to make a living. Every man's got to live."
"Come on," Sean held out his right hand. "Let's call it a deal." Mr. Goldberg hesitated a second longer. Then he put his pudgy hand in Sean's fist, and they grinned at each other. Both were satisfied. One of Mr. Goldberg's assistants counted out the sovereigns, stacking them in piles of 50 along the counter. Then Sean and Mr. Goldberg checked them and agreed once more. Sean filled 2 canvas bags with the gold, slapped Mr. Goldberg's back, helped himself to another cigar, and headed, heavily laden, for the bank.
"When are you going into the veldt again?" Mr. Goldberg called after him.
"Soon," said Sean.
"Don't forget to get your supplies here."
"I'll be back," Sean assured him.
Emby Janey carried one of the bags and Sean the other. Sean was smiling, and streamers of cigar smoke swirled back from his head as he strode along the sidewalk. There's something in the weight of a sack of gold that makes the man who holds it stand 8 feet tall. That night, as they lay together in the darkness of the wagon, Katrina asked him,
"Have we enough money to buy the farm yet, Sean?"
"Yes," said Sean. "We've got enough for the finest farm in the whole Cape Peninsula. And after one more trip, we'll have enough to build the house and the barns, buy the cattle, lay out the vineyard, and still have some left over."
Katrina was silent for a moment. Then,
"So we are going back into the bush veldt again?"
"One more trip," said Sean. "Another 2 years, and then we'll go down to the Cape." He gave her a hug. "You don't mind, do you?"
"No," she said. "I think I'd like that. When will we leave?"
"Not just yet a while," Sean laughed. "First, we're going to have some fun."
He hugged her again. Her body was still painfully thin. He could feel the bones of her hips pressed against him.
"Some pretty clothes for you, my fancy, and a suit for me that doesn't look like a fancy dress. Then we'll go out and see what this burg has to offer in the way of entertainment."
He stopped as the idea swelled up in his mind.
"Damn it, I know what we'll do. We'll hire a carriage and go across to Joburg. We'll take a suite at the Grand National Hotel and do some living. Bathe in a china bath. Sleep in a real bed. You can have your hair prettied up, and I'll have my beard trimmed by a barber. We'll eat crayfish and penguin eggs. I can't remember when I last tasted pork or mutton. We'll wash it down with the old bubbling wine and waltz to a good band."
Sean raced on. And when he stopped for breath, Katrina asked softly,
"Isn't the waltz a very sinful dance, Sean?"
Sean smiled in the darkness.
"It certainly is."
"I'd like to be sinful just once, not too much, just a little with you, to see what it's like."
"We will be," said Sean, "as wicked as hell."